loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was summoned to the White House this morning as rumors swirled that he had either resigned or would be fired. Neither happened, but in Rosenstein's meeting with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, he requested a meeting with the president on Thursday. The speculation now is that he will resign then. Next, federal prosecutors in New York are weighing criminal charges against former Obama White House General Counsel Greg Craig amid allegations that he failed to register as a foreign agent in a probe that is linked to the Paul Manafort investigation. Prosecutors are also considering charges against Craig's former law firm, international legal powerhouse Skadden Arps. Then Moscow will bolster Syria's air defense following the downing of a Russian plane last week by sending a modern S-300 air defense system to the Syrian army in the next 2 weeks. That's according to the Russian defense minister. The decision was made by Russian President Vladimir Putin personally because of Israeli involvement in the plane's shootdown. And then, as Senate Republicans push for a quick vote this week on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, Senate Democrats are investigating a new allegation of sexual misconduct against him. Deborah Ramirez, who went to Yale with Kavanaugh, said that he exposed himself to her at a party. This is the second sexual harassment allegation against Brett Kavanaugh. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Washington. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was summoned to the White House this morning as rumors swirled that he had either resigned or would be fired. Neither happened, but in Rosenstein's meeting with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, he requested a meeting with the president on Thursday. The speculation now is that he will resign then. We're joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com, R-A-L-L.com. And we're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Good to have both of you.
Likewise.
Good to be here.
Dan, let's start with you. You know, so much was made this morning. I mean, Washington lit up when Axios published a very short piece. It was just a headline, really, saying that Rosenstein was resigning because he had been summoned to the White House to be fired. That wasn't exactly the case. But the reason why Washington was buzzing was because this is the one thing that Senate Republicans have been begging the president not to do. Don't fire Rosenstein, with the conventional wisdom being if he fires Rosenstein, who was responsible for hiring Mueller, the person that replaces Rosenstein could then fire Mueller. So where does this leave us vis-a-vis Robert Mueller?
I guess it means that Mueller is safe for the moment, presuming these rumors are false. I mean, Washington is this giant, hyperactive rumor mill. You just count on these things, and we don't know what to make of them. It's just like, you know, they're as hyperactive as Trump's tweets. It's just barely controlled hysteria. But I think the Mueller investigation looks like it's going to go forward. And so far, it's turning up nothing about collusion. It's turning up petty corruption involving Paul Manafort and others, but nothing about collusion. So it's all very anticlimactic.
Ted Rall, walk us through the import or lack of import of this thing. Rod Rosenstein, I mean, nobody ever heard of Rod Rosenstein before a year ago. And all of a sudden, he's a hero of the Democrats, despite the fact that he says he's a registered independent. Why is he so important? Or maybe the better question is he less important than many of us think he is? Does this resignation or firing, whatever it is, really matter in the greater scheme of things?
I'm going to answer the better question. And I think the answer is no. I don't think he is as important as we've been led to believe over and over again. Just because official Washington says it's so doesn't mean that it is. Mm. I think Mueller is key. And I don't even think, and I've been saying this for a while, I don't even think Mueller's as important as people think. I think Democrats are deluded if they think that we're going to get much more out of Mueller than a big, thick report that nobody's going to read. And I mean, it's, you know, I mean, it'll be convenient for propping open doors that are jammed and stuff like that. But it's not going to change anything. We're not going to get, I mean, I think in the fondest dreams of the Democrats, Mueller issues a blockbuster report that leads to Trump getting frog marched out of the White House by the FBI. And it's a great fantasy and it's very Hollywood. But look, if I were Donald Trump or I would advising him, I would tell him fire Mueller yesterday. Everyone's going to freak out and they're going to forget all about it when like Angelina Jolie does or says something. It's going to be all over. And I think Trump, in the back of his mind, probably understands that he doesn't really need to put up with all this for very long. So with Rosenstein, I don't know how much longer he's going to be around. If I were Trump, I'd get rid of him just purely on the Godfather doctrine that you always get rid of your enemies whenever you can. And, you know, anyone who wants to deploy the 25th Amendment against you is your enemy. So for that reason, he's toast. But is it going to matter in terms of Trump's presidency going on for much longer? I don't think it's going to make any difference whatsoever.
Daniel Lazar, I agree with Ted. We've had this investigation drag on now for, my goodness, how long? Well over a year. And what we've seen, Manafort aside, because Manafort's crimes had nothing to do with collusion. The prosecutors just sort of stumbled on them in the course of their investigations. But what we've had is a whole bunch of throwaway felonies, which we all predicted. We've seen things like making a false statement or perjury or conspiracy or bank fraud, wire fraud, things that have nothing to do with collusion, things that have nothing to do with trying to influence an election. So would you agree with Ted that we're not going to see the FBI marching Donald Trump out of the White House, that this is just going to go away after a while?
Yes, I basically agree with that. I mean, it depends what happens with the midterm elections. But yeah, I think that's basically correct. One point I would disagree about is that I think that Trump understands that since Mueller will not come up with any kind of, you know, blockbuster revelation, he's kind of content to let him putter on and indict a few low-level people, knowing that he will not be able to reach the president himself. So he's playing a waiting game and hopes to be vindicated on election day.
Ted Rall, that actually makes sense to me. But what do you think would happen if there is an indictment of, let's say, Donald Trump Jr. or Jared Kushner, even if it's one of these throwaway felonies? How do you think things turn then?
Well, again, if I'm advising the president, and really the more I think about this, he really should hire me. I'm better than a lot of the people he has.
Well, you've got to be better than Rudy Giuliani at the very least.
Yeah, for sure. I would tell him, you know, hey, if they indict your son or your son-in-law, pardon them. Everyone's going to understand it. Even most partisan Democratic voters deep down would understand pardoning your relative or your son. In fact, it would be weird if he didn't. So I think, I mean, this president will truly be able to operate with impunity for a while, unless somehow collusion gets pulled out of a gunny sack, and somehow the smoking gun that's been so elusive for over 2 years finally turns up. But failing that, and it better be a blockbuster. There's just not, you know, I don't see anything changing. It's going to be a I do think that the midterm elections are going to matter, but I also don't think that the Democrats are going to want to impeach Trump unless they have something massive.
Right. Evidence of real crimes.
Yeah, exactly.
Daniel Lazar, do you see any parallels between what we're seeing right now and Archibald Cox and the eventual resignation of Richard Nixon?
No, I see absolute disparity. I mean, there was a real crime in Watergate. They caught these guys red-handed breaking into the Democratic National Committee headquarters. And so there was a real crime to investigate. It was apparent very soon that the crime had been ordered by someone in the White House. So it's a question of just simply tracing, you know, tracing the responsibility up to the Oval Office. there has been no crime here, no crime at all. No one's proved a crime, at least. I mean, the question of collusion is, to quote Deripaska, the Russian oligarch, is preposterous. Trump did not collude with Putin. He won the election on his own merits, or at least he won the Electoral College on his own merits. And Democrats are so desperate to pin this on the Russians because they're afraid to look at their own shortcomings. And this is what this is why the midterms is important. If Trump emerges from the midterms stronger than it was previously, these investigations will just vanish because it's clear that Trump has succeeded in shoring up his base, and the Democrats just have no idea how to fight him politically. They can only try to fight him legally and prosecutorially.
Ted Rall, we have a minute and 15 seconds left, and you get the last word.
That's tough because that's a hard act to follow. I so completely agree. That's right. I mean, the Democrats are somehow completely hapless, unable or unwilling to articulate any kind of ideological or policy vision to make a case to the voters. And so they're going to try to get this guy out on the strength of his alleged crimes. But what they're missing is that they haven't gamed this out to the nth degree. Even if Donald Trump hung out with Vladimir Putin and he's president because of that, and he gets caught and he gets impeached as a result, that's not going to leave the Democrats anywhere other than as the party of default. There's still not going to be an affirmative reason to vote Democratic, and they need to have that. This is electoral politics, and it seems like the party is so riven between the civil war between the progressive wing and the corporatist wing that they have decided just not to bother to have any ideology whatsoever. And that's a sure loser.
Oh, I agree. I think you are absolutely right. That's something that would be a great subject for a standalone segment. But we'll leave it there. We were joined from New York by Ted Rall, an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at rall.com. And we were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We have a lot more coming up.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Federal prosecutors in New York are weighing criminal charges against former Obama White House General Counsel Greg Craig amid allegations that he failed to register as a foreign agent in a probe that's linked to the Paul Manafort investigation. Prosecutors are also considering charges against Craig's former law firm, international legal powerhouse Skadden Arps. We're joined from New York by Jim Cavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net. Jim's latest article is Be Careful What You Ask For, Wasting Time with Manafort, Cohen, and Russiagate. Always good to have you, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for having me, John.
Jim, Greg Craig is one of the most important Democrats in America behind the scenes. He is a major powerhouse political attorney, lobbyist, John Kerry's best friend, Barack Obama's attorney, and now he's being sucked into this investigation. What do you make of this? Is this just the Mueller team farming out violations of the FARA Act as they find them, or is this a real problem?
Well, the real problem is, as you say, he's part of the deep Democratic state, you know, the permanent state, right? He's one of these guys who, behind the scenes, is everywhere doing everything for a lot of people, and goes straight from Obama White House to work for Paul Manafort. You know, this is the swamp. And they're all reptiles in the swamp. And he's one of the reptiles that goes around Washington and makes his money by selling his influence to various people. And he, along with Manafort, did that and sold it to the Ukrainian government when under Yanukovych. And the problem here for Manafort is Manafort, as I said, I think in my piece that you mentioned, Manafort is just one of these guys. You know, they're Democrats, they're Republicans, they're neither, they're both. And Craig is one of these guys. So Manafort has to, for good reasons, Manafort farmed out most of these things. This guy Craig and another guy, the Vander Swat or something, was the first guy actually who pled guilty, who had a first conviction for influence peddling and under the Foreign Agents Registration Act and blah, blah. But he kept the Manafort trial under those same charges for himself. So it's interesting that he did that. He must have thought Manafort was a more important character. He was the person, I guess, that Craig here was working for also. But it's really the Foreign Agents Registration. In fact, I think even what the Post says today, it's been haphazardly enforced since World War II.
Yeah, it has been.
So, you know, this is just, they're going to enforce it for political reasons when they want to. But the threat here is that, you know, they have to kind of enforce it on everybody, at least look like right now they're enforcing it on everybody, in order for it not to look like it's just a thing of Democrats against Republicans. So you get into this swamp. I mean, other reptiles are going to appear. I mean, you can't really go after everybody who does this because it's everybody in Washington.
That's exactly what the problem is. It's everybody in Washington. This is one of those laws that's been on the books a long time. Nobody's paid any attention to it over the years. Even professional lobbyists, for whatever reason, never get around to filling out the paperwork, and so they don't register. Well, generally, nobody cares if they don't register. But then you've got this case against Paul Manafort et al., and when you're trying to heap on these throwaway felonies to get him to take a deal eventually, which is what happened, then you've got to be consistent. You can't be a hypocrite, and you're going to have to charge everybody with not registering as a foreign agent. Well, half of Washington has failed to register as a foreign agent. That's what we're coming down to here. So even if Greg Craig is found guilty or takes a plea, you don't go to jail normally over things like this. He may get a slap on the hands. He may be suspended from practicing law for a year. But is this really the best way to spend the taxpayers' money? And I ask you that not because it's Greg Craig. I don't care about Greg Craig one way or the other, although I'll tell you my one encounter with him. But is this, you know, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, is this really how the taxpayers' money should be spent?
It's really a question of what's the point of it? I mean, if there's real corruption here, and if this is real corruption, these kinds of working for foreign governments in the way that he did, which is to prepare reports that would help the government actually get along better with the United States, which is what it was, then you should go after it. But again, you have to go after it for everybody. And nobody really is taking this seriously. You can't do that. So it is kind of obviously opportunistic and selective prosecution. It's like laws against jaywalking. You know, who gets stopped for that? It's only going to be the people the cops want to stop for some other reason.
Yeah, exactly.
and usually they're black in that case. Here, in this case, it's, you know, they can't kind of make it look like it's only their friends or people who work for Trump. So they got to kind of have to get some Democrats in there.
Round up some Democrats. Yeah. And, you know, we could talk about Tony Podesta, who was involved with the same things that Craig and Manafort were involved in. I want to tell you real quickly, and this is really apropos of nothing, but my one dealing with Greg Craig, when I was on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff, I wanted to do an investigation of the seven white families that control the Haitian economy. Most Haitians, of course, are black. There are these seven white families that really control the entire economy of Haiti. And frankly, they keep people poor. And so I decided I was going to go to Haiti. I was going to investigate this. And before I could even hit the ground running, John Kerry told me to stop. And I said, why? I said, this is a case of true economic injustice. This is something that we ought to be highlighting. And he said, no, because Greg Craig represents these seven white families. I said, so what? And Kerry said, so Greg Craig is my best friend, and I'm telling you, kill this investigation. And, you know, that's how Washington works. Well, now the Democrats aren't in the White House, and there's nobody to say, kill this investigation of Greg Craig. Now there's a criminal investigation. He may very well be charged with a felony.
Wow, that's a fantastic story, John. And that should be headlines. I mean, that's the kind of corruption that goes on all the time.
All the time. That's Washington.
This guy's now under investigation. Something, as you say, might be brought against him. I doubt maybe they'll give him 30 days in jail if they have to give him jail time. But this is not going to – people will hide out for a while and lay low and make sure they submit their FARA registration forms, and But a year from now, it's going to come back to the same thing.
Oh, yeah, it will. It always does. It returns to its point of equilibrium, always. It blows over. Everybody registers right now. A year from now, they start forgetting to register again. And, you know, it's funny, too, Jim. It's a very simple, you know, one-page piece of paperwork saying, I'm going to do business on behalf of the government of X, and this is what they're paying me. And it becomes a public record, and it just kind of sits there on a database, and no big deal. But people just don't do it. They just don't get around to doing it. And in today's America, that is a felony.
Yep. They're going to enforce it when they want.
When they want. And that's the key. And, you know, another thing, too, I pontificate a lot about how Congress over-criminalizes and over-regulates us. There's a wonderful book called Three Felonies a Day, written by Harvey Silverglade, a Harvard law professor, in which he argues that we're so over-criminalized, over-legislated, over-regulated in this country that the average American on the average day going about his or her normal business commits three felonies every single day. Well, this is one of those felonies for a lot of Washingtonians. And you have to really focus on the word felony, because if you forget to fill out this paperwork, you can't vote. You lose the right to own a handgun or any kind of gun for the rest of your life. I mean, there are serious consequences that come with this, in addition to the possibility of prison and the possibility of a six-figure legal bill that you're going to have to worry about just for not filling out this paperwork. And as you point out, Jim, it's selectively prosecuted. It's selectively investigated. And, if the Justice Department doesn't like your face, you may be the guy that they go after.
And that, you point out something important. This is what, to answer your questions before, you have to, why do we have laws that are only possibly selectively prosecuted, can only possibly be selectively prosecuted? So that's what you got to look at. There is a bunch. I love that book, and I love that, and I know that.
Oh, I do too. Read it twice.
And this is all kinds of stuff that's going on in the country around that, you know, civil forfeiture and things like that, which are crazy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Knows about. And so there is a lot of over criminalization. But again, it's there in order as tools that the prosecutorial state can pick up when it wants for other reasons. And that's what's happening. So, I mean, nobody's going to go after Joe Biden for his son getting a job, being rewarded with a seat on the Ukrainian oil, gas company.
That's right. That's true.
And that was probably done with the correct paperwork. it's substantively, clearly a reward for the service that Joe Biden rendered to the current Ukrainian regime. And everybody knows it. So,
indeed,
you know, if we're going to be serious about relationship and policing relationships between lobbyists and influencers and foreign regimes, then we've got to do a lot more than this.
We have to be consistent. We're going to have to leave it there, Jim. We were joined from New York by Jim Kavanaugh, the editor of thepolemicist.net. Check out his latest article, Be Careful What You Ask For, Wasting Time with Manafort, Cohen, and Russiagate. We'll talk to you soon, Jim. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Moscow will bolster Syria's air defense following the downing of a Russian plane last week by sending a modern S-300 air defense system to the Syrian army in the next 2 weeks, according to the Russian defense minister. The decision was made by Russian President Vladimir Putin personally because of Israeli involvement in the plane's shootdown. We're joined from Moscow by Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. Mark, it's always good to have you.
John, thanks for having me. It's always an honor and a pleasure to be on Loud and Clear.
Well, the pleasure's mine. And let me start by asking you if I'm reading too much into this. This seems like a monumental change in relations between Russia and Israel for a couple of reasons. First of all, it seems like this may mean an end to Russian-Israeli coordination or communications about their operations in Syrian airspace. And secondly, Israel has acted as a middleman in the very recent past between the United States and Russia. Well, now if the Russians are having this kind of defense problem or military problem with the Israelis, would that relationship also end?
It's certainly a down step in Russian Israeli relations. I mean, first of all, you can't get around the fact of the Russian reconnaissance plane, the Il-20, shot down over Syria, the Russian Ministry of Defense, very adamant in blaming Israel for using a direct stratagem of using this reconnaissance plane for cover while launching an illegal, for more than the 200th illegal aggressive attack on Syria by aircraft, over this time over the Mediterranean off the coast, which brought down the plane. And Russia's supplying of the S-300 to Syria will definitely be viewed negatively in Israel. They have long lobbied against Syria acquiring this system because they have long, abused Syria's sovereignty and really regard Syrian, Lebanese, and other neighbors' airspace as an extension of their own. You know, they have violated it with impunity. And it is very likely that this, if it will not end, will at least make it a far more dangerous venture for the Israeli Air Force. They will now have to be at the least very careful. It is not clear whether Russia at this point intends to make all of Syria now essentially a no-fly zone for Israeli aircraft. That is not clear. That would definitely further degrade Russian-Israeli relations. Russia announced not only that they're delivering the S-300 system, but that they are delivering an automated control system to all of Syria's air defense command positions. This will basically integrate it with Russia's Identify Friend or Foe, IFF systems, so that such incident can't be repeated. And it will also further integrate Syria's air defense into one network interconnected with Russia's own air defense there. Now, Syria already has Russia's older S-200, some Panzer S-1 short-range air defense systems, a number of other older Soviet systems, and Russia has already several S-300 systems, including a naval-based off of Russian ships in the area, and multiple of the even more advanced S-400 systems that are in Syria. These will now all be interconnected into one network that will utilize Russian Identify Friend or Foe, completely automated so that such mistakes can't be made. Every aircraft flying in Syrian airspace will now be accessed and identified, and it will immediately be determined whether it is indeed a friend, meaning Syrian or Russian, or something else that is allowed, or whether it is not. The third measure that Russia announced that they will take is that they will begin electronic warfare jamming of any attacking aircraft or ships, and it has to be remembered that French ships were also involved in this incident, firing missiles into Syria, that will hinder satellite navigation, radar, and other systems vital for conducting attacks from sea. So this is a three definite steps of defense, all directly related to this incident where 15 Russian servicemen died. And it may not be the last measure taken. There may be further military defense and political measures taken.
Well, we know that that Benjamin Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, called President Putin today to ask him to reverse this decision and not send the S-300 system to Syria. Putin refused to consider that and said that the delivery would be made indeed in the next 2 weeks. So what exactly does that mean for Israel? Are the Israelis going to be able to continue to harass the Syrians or to confront the Russians? The reason I ask is I've been to Syria. A lot of us have been to Syria. And one of the things that really stunned me when I was there was that Israeli fighter jets will routinely fly directly over Damascus, go low over the presidential palace in Damascus, and then turn around and fly back to Israel. And they do that just to harass, just to remind the Syrians that if they wanted to bomb Damascus, they could quite easily. Well, now the Russians are involved, not just there physically, but now there's this S-300 system coming. How is that going to change Israeli tactics in the region?
I would say that that has already, the situation that you're talking about has already ended some time ago when Russian delivered at the least the Panzer S-1, the shorter range air defense system, to Syria and in the conflict. Lately, all of Israel's strikes have been either off the coast, in Lebanese space, or very quick in and out raids, as it were, through looking for holes or weak points in what has increasingly become an integrated Russian-Syrian air defense system over the entirety of their country, and now may in fact become such a fully integrated system like it never has before. We don't know how many S-300 systems Russia will deliver to Syria. Some people say they already have been delivered and have just never been unboxed. Previously at the express request, and we must assume some deal making with the Israeli prime minister that stopped earlier. And I think, these systems were already promised to be delivered several times now. And I think if Russia backed it down once again at this point, it would really be seen as a weakness. And personally, I think the Russian Ministry of Defense actually laid down the law to Putin on this, saying this should have already been done. This is what is necessary to protect our service members, and there is no political reason great enough not to have this system to protect our people if our troops and bases are going to be there in the line of fire, as we've seen. So we don't know how many they're going to be delivered, and we don't know whether Russian air defense will now more actively, Russian air defense has never targeted Israeli aircraft in Syria that is owned and operated by Russians.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because there's breaking news on the Sputnik News website. There's a piece that says new data clearly indicates that Syrian S-200 missile targeted Israeli jets, according to the Ministry of Defense. Details to follow. So there's no text here other than that it was a Syrian S-200 missile targeting Israeli jets.
Yeah. I mean, Russia doesn't operate S-200. They're an older system, and the Russian military doesn't operate them anymore. So these were obviously older systems. And it must be said that also Israel has lost some leverage with Russia, because Israel was supporting openly, they've openly admitted it, in the past 6 months. And, it's long been known that they were supporting Islamist insurgents, rebels, in South Syria along the Israeli and Jordanian border. That whole military area has now been cleared and is in the control of the Syrian government, all the way up to the Golan Heights, the Israeli occupied Syria on Golan Heights, which is now being policed on different sides by the UN and indeed by Russian troops as well. So Israel had that leverage that they might act to defend these insurgents in South Syria, but that has all been cleared. So they don't have that leverage anymore. And it would be much harder for Israel to make another insurgency appear in South Syria. They can't just snap their fingers and have it return and become a major factor again. So Israel has much less leverage to use with Russia. Russia needs Israel less. They're already becoming essentially a non-factor in the war, bar out an all-out attack on Damascus. It is likely that what Russia is delivering to Syria is enough to make Israel, at the very least, question and have to plan and choose very carefully if they choose to make airstrikes again in Syria.
It'll certainly be a lot riskier.
Yes, a bit riskier. If they were, of course, to mount an all-out war, including a full, air force attack on Syria, obviously they could overwhelm these systems. There's no question about that. But I mean, that is an entirely different level of conflict than what we're talking about or is likely here. Israel has promised that it will make attacks again in recent days. At least they announced it before the S-300 decision. And if so, I would look to see them attempt to make some attack in the near future, at whatever range, because the S-300 will now put all of Lebanese space, Syrian airspace, the coastal airspace, and indeed much of Israeli airspace within range of what will now be Syrian S-300 air defense system. So, but they may have to prove that they can continue to act with impunity despite this. So we may see an altercation within the next month to test this.
You heard it first from Mark Sloboda, who joined us from Moscow. He's an international relations and security analyst. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. As Senate Republicans push for a quick vote this week on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, Senate Democrats are investigating a new allegation of sexual misconduct against him. Deborah Ramirez, who went to Yale University with Kavanaugh, said that he exposed himself to her at a party. This is the second allegation of sexual harassment against Brett Kavanaugh. We're joined from Geneva, New York by Professor Hannah Dickinson. She's associate professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and she's a noted women's advocate. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We're glad to have you. This is getting uglier and uglier as the weeks go by. I was disappointed, Hannah, in a comment that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made when this second allegation was made public. He said that there was even more of a necessity to ram this nomination through the Senate. That's exactly the opposite of what many of us would hope our elected officials would have to say. But now with a second accuser coming out, this seems to have taken on yet more import. What do you make of it?
Yeah, thanks for that question. I mean, in the biggest possible terms, I think this second allegation makes clear that an investigation is necessary here. We have now two credible allegations of sexual assault against someone who is looking to be appointed to the Supreme Court. And so, right, not only are the next steps, I think, quite clear in terms of what should be done to make sure that this is a thorough nomination process, but it also starts to tell us some things we probably already know about how the Supreme Court works, right? It is clearly a sort of dictatorship of the rich, where wealthy men who are well-connected are clearly invested in protecting their own before they get on the court and then once they're there as well.
I think that's sadly correct. There was a fascinating piece in Newsweek that was just published today. It's an interview with Elizabeth Rasor. She's Mark Judge's ex-girlfriend. Now, Mark Judge was Brett Kavanaugh's best friend at Georgetown Prep. Elizabeth Rasor was his girlfriend. And she said something that I think is very, very important. She says that she felt, quote, morally obligated to challenge Judge's account that no horseplay took place at Georgetown Prep with women, unquote, adding that she could, quote, not stand by and watch him lie, unquote. It goes on to say, in fact, Rasor alleges that Judge admitted to engaging in an arguably far more disturbing act, saying he ashamedly told her of an incident in which he and other boys took turns, quote, having sex with a drunk woman, unquote. Brian Becker and I last week talked about how behavior like this, illegal behavior like this, is sadly quite common in upper crust prep schools in places like Washington and New York and elsewhere around the country. It's not horseplay. It's a sex crime. And, you know, I'm wondering why the entire country doesn't recognize it for what it is.
That's a great question. Yeah, I mean, I think this is such an interesting case for the ways in which the Me Too movement has already been pointing out the ways in which sexual assault and sexual harassment are endemic in all segments of U.S. culture, right? But I think these allegations against Brett Kavanaugh and against his friend point to the ways in which some people have particular kinds of access to cover-ups, right? So it helps us see the ways in which the ruling class reproduces itself, that Republican operatives have been working from very early in Kavanaugh's career to set him up for a job like this, perhaps just this job. And the real crimes that he and his friends and cronies cover up sort of call into question the ruling class's ability to really stand up for and look out for working and oppressed people, and perhaps in this case, women in particular.
Tell us what we should expect to see this week so that it's not a repeat of the Anita Hill hearings several decades ago. How do you think Democrats will handle the Kavanaugh hearing differently from the way they handled it in the early 1990s? They botched it, frankly, with Anita Hill.
They did, and I have to admit, John, I don't have super high hopes this time around either. I do think one of the lessons that we can take from the Anita Hill hearings is the recent remarks by our former Vice President Joe Biden that it was a mistake not to call the additional witnesses. So I hope that's a lesson that the Democrats in Congress take to heart, that they do speak with anyone who has information that might shed some light on Judge Kavanaugh's past history and ability to be a Supreme Court justice. But I think another lesson from the Anita Hill hearings that's really important to recall is the massive grassroots mobilization by African-American women in particular during and in response to the Anita Hill hearings. We might recall the New York Times ad that was run by thousands of African-American women in defense of themselves. And the kinds of important grassroots and activist work that followed, right, once it was very clear that the stories and experiences of women, and particularly African-American women, were not going to be taken seriously enough for even a full hearing. So I think two lessons to take away here, the importance of a thorough investigation and also the importance of not just those Democrats and Republicans in the room there, but all of the women in particular who right now are furious and demanding to be taken seriously.
There are some credible allegations against Representative Keith Ellison, an up-and-coming star in the Democratic Party. He also happens to be the deputy chairman of the Democratic Party. And that is that he has been physically abusive with women in the past. He said on Friday something that I thought was very disturbing. He said that he cannot rule out that there won't be additional abuse allegations brought against him in the future. What do you make of that? And do you think that there's a double standard between Republicans and Democrats?
Well, John, I mean, these are certainly troubling allegations, and this is information that needs to be examined. But it's important, I think, that we recognize that Kavanaugh's being considered for the highest judicial body in the land, that this needs to go under intense scrutiny, and that the Republicans have made very clear that it is their plan to get this confirmation hearing done as quickly as possible. They had the second allegations from Deborah Ramirez a week ago, and that has not changed their tune one bit, except, in fact, to encourage them to move more quickly. So I absolutely, right, any allegations of sexual assault or harassment or violence against women need to be investigated, right, no matter who those allegations are against. But I think any talk of double standards or whataboutism at this case is designed by Republican operatives as a distraction. So we should talk about Ellison because that's important, right? But not. We should also be able to not take our eye off the ball here and remember the really serious stakes involved in this Supreme Court nomination.
Let's get back to Kavanaugh for a moment, too. There's a piece in The New Yorker that has really brought this new allegation to light. It's written by Jane Mayer and Ronan Farrow, two of the most important writers, in my view, in America today. I mean, Ronan Farrow is the one who broke the Me Too story when NBC tried to cover it up, and he went to The New Yorker and broke it there. And Jane Mayer has done more against torture than I think any other journalist in America. So they're two very serious journalists. They're the ones saying that Kavanaugh sexually harassed this second woman. Her name is Deborah Ramirez. She attended Yale with Kavanaugh, and she says that freshman year, and this is quite graphic. She says that freshman year, he exposed himself to her at a party. Now, if you're accused of doing something like this once and it's true, okay, shame on you. If you're accused of doing it twice, that's the establishment of a pattern, it seems to me. And I would have to assume also that there are other women who just haven't come forward yet. Because if you've got two, maybe then you have three or five or 10. What do you make of these new accusations? And do you think that there will be other women who come forward?
That's a great question, John. I'll just add, you know, one other component of the pattern here are some of the reports by law students who then went on to clerk for Kavanaugh, who claimed they were told by Amy Chua that he was looking for a particular type of woman, right? So there's yet this other sort of piece of the ways in which Kavanaugh and his cronies are actually trafficking in women. In a sense, right, through all three of these allegations that women are not understood as colleagues or equal or brilliant legal minds, but property to be horseplayed with, assaulted, and looked at. So, right, I mean, that's enough for me, right? Like, that clearly in and of itself is disgusting and disqualifying.
I wonder if Democrats are holding something in reserve that they intend to spring this week in these hearings, some sort of October surprise.
I think it's possible. And, you know, it's a massive PR game that both Republicans and Democrats are playing here. So I wouldn't be surprised if we saw additional allegations. But I guess I would also just add some caution here, just because if we do not hear additional allegations, that doesn't mean that Brett Kavanaugh hasn't harassed and assaulted other women. I think it's notable here that we have two well-educated, well-respected professional women coming forward here because what's at stake for them? We learned this with Anita Hill, and we learned this over and over again with sexual assault allegations, that what's at stake for these women are death threats, are a life in the spotlight, are risks to their jobs and to their bodily autonomy. So the risks of coming forward in a case like this are massive, and not all women are in a position to take that risk.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from Geneva, New York by Professor Hannah Dickinson. She's an associate professor at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and she's a women's advocate. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today, we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book, Demand the Impossible, A Radical Manifesto. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks, John. It's good to hear your voice.
The pleasure's mine, Bill. Bill, we've spoken about Arne Duncan, the former Secretary of Education, a number of times on the show, and we've criticized him, but we've not really gone into any depth. Well, Arne Duncan has a new book out. It's something that you mentioned last week, and I'd like to talk about that. It's called How Schools Work, which is kind of funny to me and ironic. How Schools Work, an inside account of failure and success from one of the nation's longest serving secretaries of education. Tell us about this book.
Well, I read it so that you don't have to. It is in the form of a memoir, but it's really a kind of an apology or a defense of his 12 years being an educational leader. And it's marked with problems from top to bottom, starting with the opening sentence. The opening sentence of the book says, education runs on lies. And that's really the theme of the book. It's not really a book about how schools work. In fact, he rarely gets into even a nod in the direction of what kinds of improvements we need. It's really a book about, in defense of his leadership of the nation's schools for 8 years and Chicago schools for 4 years. And I'll tell you a couple things about it. One is that the big lie that he exposes in that opening chapter, he isn't exactly wrong about, but it just becomes a theme that overwhelms everything else. What he's arguing is that he met a kid in Chicago 30 years ago, and the kid was doing well in school, getting B's and so on. And as Arnie was tutoring this kid, he realized that the kid was functionally illiterate. And the big lie that he takes on is the lie of social promotion. That is the lie of a system that says you're doing okay when you're not doing okay. Where that leads him is to believe that the basic reform that we need in education is to raise the standards and hold all students and all teachers accountable. One of the problems, of course, is that accountability itself is a word that gets selectively applied. So he's interested in what he calls accountability for teachers based on student test scores, but he's not interested in accountability for government, for corporations, for foundations who are driving this. And that's only the tip of the iceberg of what the problems are in this book. But it's really not about how schools work. It's really a defense of all his years in being an educational leader.
Bill, you've got a new book coming out soon. We've been touting your most recent book, Demand the Impossible, but tell us about this new one.
Well, I have a book that came out after Demand the Impossible called You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. And that was an attempt to take on what I consider the falsehoods that have been driving, you know, corporate school reform for two decades. And it really takes them on. It takes on the myths one by one. You can't fire the bad ones. I contend that's a myth. Teachers unions are the biggest obstacle to improving education. That's a myth that we take on in this book. Teachers unions represent a flock of go slow status quo sheep. We take that on and so on. So, you know, one of the problems in contrasting that book with Arne Duncan, I mean, when he talks about education and lies or the school system and lies, what he doesn't talk about is, for example, poverty. The fact is that poverty is linked very, very closely to school success and underfunding and inequitable funding. But these are issues that he doesn't want to talk about. So the big lies in educational reform these days are things like poverty doesn't matter. Test scores are illuminating, which they are not. And we'll talk about that today or in a future conversation. But so what my book attempts to do, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, attempts to do is take on the pillars of this corporate school reform agenda and take them down one by one. The book that's coming out this year, though, is a different book, and it's called School, 10 Questions and 10 Answers About Becoming a Teacher. And it's really like part of a series that are like pamphlets for new teachers. We have one called 10 Questions and 10 Answers About Gender Identity, 10 Questions and 10 Answers About Poverty. So we're trying to create very useful, small books you can put in your back pocket and take to the school board meeting or into the school itself. But my next book, this one that's coming out, is has chapters like, you know, what can I do now to prepare for becoming a teacher? How can I create an outstanding learning environment? What's my role in testing and assessment? Questions like that. But it's more geared towards young teachers or people who are thinking of becoming teachers. Those are kind of in contrast to what I think is going to sell many more copies, but is not a very useful book. And that's Arne Duncan's How Schools Work.
Right.
The other thing, just say one other thing, John, about Arnie's book, because, you know, what you would really like is somebody in a position of power to take an honest look at what they had done and what they'd failed to do and engage the conversation that's going on. He avoids the conversation like the plague. And while he's critical, he uses very strong language in being critical of himself. He says, "We absolutely made some mistakes," he says on page 147. And then the mistakes always boil down to this. We failed to communicate why annual testing is good. Or he says at one point, "I put my foot in my mouth when I blamed suburban mothers for not supporting my approach to school change." And he says, "It was a lack of tact, and I deserve to be criticized for my lack of tact." But nothing about the content. It reminded me of that great classic film Cool Hand Luke.
Oh yeah.
Where the prisoner and the captain are in constant conversation, they're in constant conflict, and every time the conflict comes to a head, the captain of the prison says, "Oh, what we have here is a failure to communicate." And the joke of that phrase is actually what we have here is a fundamentally different worldview, different view of what should be going on. That's true in Arnie's book. Arnie's book is very much geared towards as if we all agree that kind of privatizing the public space makes sense, or doing away with the collective voice of teachers makes sense. And on that ground, his self-criticism is, I failed to communicate.
You know, they tried that with Michelle Rhee here in the D.C. school district. There was even a documentary about it called, I think it was called Waiting for Superman. And what it ended up doing was proving the opposite of what it set out to do. And what it set out to do was to show Michelle Rhee as this savior, this Superman, Superwoman, who came to D.C. and just saved this miserable school district. And she didn't. If anything, she made it worse.
Yeah, no doubt. And Arne Duncan's in that tradition in this book, because what Michelle Rhee had a cover story in Time magazine when she first became chancellor of the Washington schools. And the opening of that story said, in effect, Michelle Rhee's done more to improve Washington school in a year and a half than most reformers have done in 20 years. And what's their evidence? Their evidence is she closed a dozen schools, she fired hundreds of teachers, and so on. And that's prima facie argument that that's school improvement. But that is not school improvement. That's an absolute myth that you're improving schools by firing teachers. You may remember that in the first year of Duncan's tenure at the Department of Education, Central Falls, Rhode Island fired all their teachers. And Arne Duncan and President Obama knew no more about it than you and I did, but they immediately used their standing and their stature to praise the school board in Central Falls, Rhode Island, for firing all the teachers in this failing school. Of course, what they don't do is go back and say, well, how does it look 8 years later? Fact is, nothing's improved. But the optics of we're in motion, we're doing something substantial, you know, kind of carried the day, and they got to claim a great success. But it wasn't a success. It was a catastrophe for the kids in Rhode Island and for the schools. So I think we have to kind of get smarter about how we read these things and how we respond to these kind of public relations moves.
Agreed. We're going to leave it there. That was the voice of Bill Ayers, who joined us from Chicago. He's an activist, educator, and the author of the book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Oh,